just a lot of what-ifs out there. Japan nuclear, China shale gas, pipeline gas from Russia into China.
Examining the future prospects for exporting Alaska gas. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the only hyperbaric chamber for dive decompression in Southeast goes away.
So if something were to happen, our people could get treated there. I mean, that was our own vested interest in it, and then it was also a service to the community and local divers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Japanese political leaders hope to revitalize the country's nuclear program. It scaled back from more than 50 nuclear reactors to less than 5 after an earthquake caused a meltdown at the Fukushima reactors in 2011. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, Japan's return to nuclear could affect Alaska's chances at large-scale exports of LNG, but factors such as cheap supplies in other countries may have a larger impact.
The Japanese parliament returned former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to power in December. Abe is a pro-business nationalist who does not want China to be the region's economic engine. Jane Nakano is an energy and national security fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says Abe recently won majorities in both houses of parliament, and that will help in his quest to restart some of the country's nuclear reactors. He'll also have to win the support of the Japanese people.
More people in the Japanese society are starting to realize that there is economic cost to not restarting any reactors. And now I think the question is how many would be the comfortable level.
After the meltdown, Japan shuttered all but 2 nuclear reactors. The country could restart more than 50. Nakano says Japan has been trying to wean itself off foreign oil since the embargo of the 1970s. Japan imports virtually all of its power, including the uranium used in the nuclear plants. Nakano says the country would like to increase both its use of nuclear and renewable energy sources.
The question is the midterm, what fuel sources besides nuclear they would be relying upon if the restart does not go as smoothly as Abe would like.
Alaska exported LNG to Japan for decades. North Slope producers who hope to one day build a gas pipeline see Japan and other Asian countries as prime markets. Larry Persley is the federal coordinator for Alaska LNG projects. He says the window isn't narrowing for the Alaska pipeline. Japan is the largest LNG customer in the world, about a third of the global market share last year. And if Japan does fire up its nuclear reactors, Persley says the country will only cut its LNG imports by about 1 or 2 billion cubic feet a day. That's not much.
That is not going to affect the market so much that it's going to eliminate Alaska or probably change Alaska. There's just a lot of what-ifs out there.
And Alaska's LNG pipeline is a giant what-if in its own right. Construction could cost between $45 billion and $65 billion. Fadul Gate is managing director of oil and gas resources at Oppenheimer, a New York-based investment firm. He says the cost of the pipeline makes the project unfeasible in the near future. Gate says Russia and Australia are better suited than Alaska to deliver gas to Japan, but the future is in East Africa, where production is cheaper.
Companies are looking at the returns that will come from their investment. And this investment could cost from $10 to $50 billion.
Alaska's pipeline would not be in operation until the 2020s at the earliest, and it's virtually impossible to predict whether Japan's economy will continue to grow until then. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Scuba diving emergencies can no longer be treated at Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau. After more than 30 years, the facility discontinued its hyperbaric chamber program and recently removed the 13-foot chamber. Now the closest chambers for public use are in Anchorage or Seattle. KTOO's Lisa Fu has this report.
Recently retired physician William Palmer remembers when the hyperbaric chamber came to Juneau.
I was diving with some of the divers from the NOAA lab, and it came up in discussion that if there was a dive accident of any significance in the local waters, there was no backup whatsoever.
Palmer was sent to Florida in the late 1970s to study undersea medicine and hyperbaric chamber operation. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the City and Borough of Juneau in 1980 and loaned a chamber to Bartlett Regional Hospital. Douglas Schleiger is the dive center manager for NOAA.
Our interest was to have a chamber there so if something were to happen, our people could get treated there. I mean, that was our own vested interest in it, and then it was also a service to the community and local divers.
Scuba divers are at risk of decompression illness, also known as the bends, which can be caused by a fast ascent, a deep dive, or a long dive. Pressurized oxygen is pumped into a hyperbaric chamber to recreate the underwater environment. Over a period of time, pressure in the chamber is brought to a normal atmospheric level. Without immediate treatment, a serious case of decompression illness could lead to paralysis or death. Over the decades, the chamber at the hospital was also used for carbon monoxide poisoning and healing wounds. Dr. Palmer says within the first 6 months of its arrival, the chamber was used to treat 10 cases of monoxide poisoning. In recent years, use of the chamber dropped. It was last used in December 2011 for wound care, which requires 20 sessions in the chamber.
And prior to that, I think it was 12 months since they had anyone in the chamber.
That's one of the reasons the hospital decided to discontinue the program. Bartlett Respiratory Therapy Director Robin Free says another is cost. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services surveyed the hospital last June and said a fire suppression system had to be put in place to continue running the chamber.
That was going to be $30,000 to $50,000.
The hospital was in charge of maintaining the chamber, but regulations changed, requiring the work be done by NOAA-certified technicians 3 times a year. Each visit would cost the hospital $3,400.
We tried to talk to NOAA and say, hey, it's your chamber. You know, if you want it compliant and run a certain way, then we need some help from you. And they were like, well, we can't do that. And so there was nowhere to go with that.
Dr. Palmer worked at the hospital when the chamber program started and when it ended.
I thought it was really, really sad to see, even though infrequently used, this very high-tech, unusual emergency facility just fall away. The point is really that when you need it, you need it.
NOAA has 7 divers in Juneau. State of Alaska agencies have about 30 in Southeast. The state's Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission website lists more than 430 active permits for Southeast dive fisheries. And there's diving for recreation, commercial work, and search and rescue. The hyperbaric chamber was moved out of Bartlett Regional Hospital 3 weeks ago and now sits in NOAA storage in Juneau, waiting to be shipped to Seattle. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska Department of Corrections officials say the disturbance at Seward's Spring Creek Correctional Center on Monday night began when inmates were ordered to make beds and clean rooms. Director of Institutions Brian Brandenburg says inmates in the segregation unit were not happy with a directive stating they would participate in morning inspection. Brandenburg compared what happened next to children throwing a tantrum. About 14 segregation inmates late Monday night yelled, broke porcelain toilets and sinks, and flooded cells. The disturbance ended about 9 hours later on Tuesday morning. Brandenburg says just one officer was on duty in the 32-man unit. According to officials, 6 prisoners suffered cuts or scrapes in the incident. One was pepper sprayed when he did not cooperate. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the long, dry summer in Interior.
What is climatologically the wet season in Interior Alaska, it has been bone dry.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Several wildfires are growing across the interior, including a human-caused blaze, which has laid low for months. The Mississippi Fire is about 20 miles southwest of Delta Junction on military training land. It started on May 30th and showed minimal activity for weeks, but Alaska Fire Service spokesman Mel Slater says it jumped to life in recent days.
Because of the winds, there was a flare-up, and the fire grew a little bit and caused a great deal of smoke to be seen in the Delta Junction area. It's still within the military impact area, so at this point there is no danger to the population with the exception of the smoke.
Mississippi Fire has burned about 1,500 acres, including several hundred this week. The AFS's Slater could not confirm if the fire was caused by military training, and U.S. Army Alaska Public Affairs Officer Major Alan Brown could not provide any information on the fire's cause.
At this time, we have no determination as to exactly how it was caused at all. That's obviously something that we'll look into as things continue and as we get the fire out.
Brown even questions the start date.
I mean, we really don't know if it started in May or if it started yesterday. We really just don't know right now.
Last month, the Army backpedaled on the cause of another wildfire on military land west of Fairbanks. After initially taking responsibility for starting the Stewart Creek fire during training, the Army has said the fire's cause has yet to be determined. The Stewart Creek fire went on to burn 85,000 acres, prompt an evacuation, and has so far cost more than $20 million to fight. The interior dry spell continues. National Weather Service climate science manager Rick Thoman says it hasn't rained much at the official recording station at Fairbanks Airport since July 20th.
Just 1/100th of an inch of rain has fallen since then. Some places around the area have gotten slightly more rain than that, maybe 4/500ths. But for what is climatologically the wet season in interior Alaska, it has been bone dry.
Thoman says tracking since June 1st shows this to be the fourth driest summer on record in Fairbanks. This summer is also solidly in the record books for heat, including 36 days of 80 degrees or hotter and 14 of 85 or higher. The Alaska Native Cultural Charter School in Anchorage has a new and bigger home just in time for the new school year. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The new building was sorely needed, says school principal Patsy Shaha. She says the old location was simply bursting at the seams.
We were maxed out at 210 over there. We couldn't fit any more students. It just wouldn't fit.
The school started in 2007 and was housed at an old furniture store on Muldoon. It didn't have its own parking lot, a playground, or a gym. Students exercised in a storage room with 8-foot ceilings. The new school has a parking lot, a playground, and a real gym, plus more classrooms. It's sandwiched between the neighborhoods of Airport Heights and Mountain View. It's a rambling 1960s-era former Anchorage public school on Brigaw that was most recently occupied by Pacific Northern Academy, a private school. In 2009, the charter school added preschool. They added 7th grade in 2011. This year, they're adding 8th grade. They use a district-approved curriculum, but supplement with lessons on Native culture and language. Shaha says days usually start like this.
We begin every day with a community gathering, and all the students and staff are in the same room, and every single day there's parents who stay also. And we say the pledge. We say the pledge in Yupik. On Mondays, we have a guest elder who speaks to the children about whatever they want to share.
Each year, students learn about a different Alaska Native cultural group. They study 2 hours of Yupik a day. Regular classes are supplemented with berry picking and ice fishing field trips, and the occasional seal skinning.
Last year, one of our teachers, her family harvested a seal. And so she brought in the seal, and she laid out this cardboard on the ground, and she took her ulu, and all the students took turns watching as she skinned it, butchered it. She talked to them about when she was a little girl and her grandma taught her in the same thing, you know, and she talked about how you use each individual part.
With less than 2 weeks until school starts, the building is undergoing a major overhaul. Shaha walks me down a long cinder block walled hallway where workers are rolling over Crayola colored paint with earth tones of blue and brown.
This is the primary wing. preschool through fourth grader on this side. And then
Shaha says when they started the school, the building was the least of their worries. Alaska Native achievement was about half that of other students, and the school was started in part to address that.
The first year of the school, the achievement scores for our first group of kids was 44% average. And last year it was 76, and it just keeps rising.
So that means that less than half were passing standardized tests. Now more than three-quarters of students are. In general, the number hovers around 50% in Anchorage and across the country. Shaha says they're getting those results through excellent curriculum and excellent teachers. Danielle Rhea teaches fifth grade at the school. Today she's calling parents to remind them to register.
Hi, Joanna. This is Danielle from the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School.
Rhea used to teach in Southwest Alaska, where she quickly learned that culturally relevant lessons got results.
I had to learn about their culture in order to teach them through their traditional ways of knowing. And once I did that, they loved learning. And that's what I find here, too, is that once they feel connected to culture, even if they're not Alaska Native, just having cultural values that are universal, they feel a sense of pride and they feel like they're a part of something and they enjoy learning.
The school focuses on community and building relationships with families.
Hi, guys.
This is all one family. This is the Simeonovs. Glad you're here.
Tabitha Gardner sits at a table near the main office with her kids filling out paperwork.
I am registering five kids today. Sixth grade, third grade, second grade, first grade, and kindergarten.
Gardner says she chose to enroll her kids in the school for several reasons, but the main one is that she wants them to learn about their Aleutic heritage, along with reading, writing, and arithmetic. And she says she also likes the sense of community at the school.
Going to the other schools, it's like, you know, you get a number, basically, and maybe a phone call once in a while or an automated phone call. You don't talk to real people.
Gardner says because of that, she'll send her sixth child to the school, too, just as soon as he's old enough. Shaha says it's that sense of community that seems to be filling up the school.
We moved into this building. It's way bigger than the other building, but we've already run out of space.
Shaha says the school has extended their lottery. They now have room for around 100 more students than last year, and slots are going fast. You don't have to be Alaska Native to attend. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Shaylin Cochran. This week on AK, doves. One of the most rapid and successful invasions of a continent did not happen in any war. It's happening now, maybe right outside your window. The Eurasian collared dove first came to North America in Florida in 1982 and was seen in Alaska as early as 2009. Experts say the dove represents no threat to the environment or native species, but it is changing how Alaska sounds. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
So this is weird. I've lived my entire adult life in Alaska, and I've never even seen a Swainson's thrush. I couldn't pick it out of a police lineup. But I listened to his song all summer long in Sitka. That goes too for the hermit and varied thrush, ruby-crowned kinglet, raven, and especially this little guy the size of a walnut who's got the biggest song of them all, the winter wren. I'm waxing on about how Sitka sounds because it's starting to change.
Kind of
coo-coo-coo-coo-coo, in a way, something kind of like that.
Paul Norwood is a local naturalist. He's talking about the Eurasian collared dove. This bird was part of his childhood in France only because it got there just before he did.
Nobody really physically brought them from one place to the next, but people changed the environment to where it was good for the doves and they started spreading. And next thing you know, by the time I was little, they were common everywhere in France, just about everywhere that there's houses or fields.
And now it turns out, my house. While working on this story, I persuaded a small team of birders, let's call them dove chasers, to help me find some of Sitka's collared doves, with limited success. The dove chasers disbanded after 2 days. On day three, I was sleeping with the window open early one morning during Alaska's June heat wave when the collared dove came to me.
Two of them just flew by. Two of those doves just flew by my window.
I just had time to get my recorder going before the doves left, but this bird is so common now in the lower 48 and in Europe that good recordings are not hard to come by. This is part of the collection of the Macaulay Library of Wild Sounds at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. David Bonter is assistant director at the lab.
I just pulled up Sitka on Google Earth here, and it's pretty remarkable that they're there, because you're separated from other communities by vast expanses of forest and water, which is certainly not conducive to these birds.
The first recorded sighting of the Eurasian collared dove in North America was in Homestead, Florida, in 1982. This was 3 or 4 years after the initial release of doves in Nassau, Bahamas, during the burglary of a pet store. The first dove sighted in Alaska was in 2009 along the Denali Highway between Anchorage and Fairbanks, about 4,500 miles from Homestead, Florida. Bonter says collared doves are programmed to move from the moment they are hatched.
They seem to have this remarkable ability to go great distances from their natal area, the place where they hatched from.
In warm climates, where the doves' preferred diet is readily available, principally seeds, they've been observed nesting 11 months of the year. Cold climates are no barrier. They're already in Scandinavia and in Iceland. Paul Norwood says the collared dove, like the dandelion and the starling, will make its home wherever we have made ours.
We created this spot for doves to move in by having feeders out, by having certain ornamental plants, and by having, for example, maple trees and other trees that they like to grow nest in. And that's not something that they'll find on, say, Kruzov. So they might go to Kruzov, but they're not going to like it.
As it happens, I'm recently back from several days on Kruzov Island, and it remains dove-free. I thought about that a lot while I was hiking, maybe too much. David Bonter at Cornell says that his lab has processed thousands of reports of this bird as it has invaded our continent over the past 2 decades, and I represent a certain minority.
I hate to say it, but you are the first person I've ever heard complain about the song of the Eurasian collar dove. A lot of folks really, really enjoy it and really appreciate it.
I'm not saying it has a bad song. I think of it as the soundtrack of another part of the world. Alaska has always been a little rough on newcomers. Paul Norwood says some inhabitants of this island may find the dove soothing. Others may find it tasty.
I mean, we had a goshawk eat a chicken on Merrill Street last fall, so you never know.
For AK, I'm Robert Woolsey in Sitka.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we are heading to the hub community of Dillingham in Bristol Bay.
My name is Wanda Fulton, and I'm from Dillingham, Alaska. I kind of do odd jobs in the community.
My name is Stephanie McCumber. I am the fire office assistant.
Dillingham looks like a fishing community. You fly in, you notice the small boat harbor with boats in it in the summer and boats all alongside it in Peter Pan's
boatyard during the winter. We're located on the Bristol Bay, the Nooshigak region. We've got lovely bay in the front, and we've also got the Woodtickchick State Park behind us with mountains and lakes.
Here in Dillingham, our big employers are probably the school district and Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation with Kanakanak Hospital and various government agencies like Fish and Game. Summer times can be beautiful, and they can be very cold and rainy. And days like this year where we've had sunshine, people like to go out hiking. The bike trail is just filled with people biking and moms pushing babies in their strollers, and people love to berry pick.
What I think is unique is how we've got, you know, waters in the front bay where you can go out salmon fishing. You also have access to the mountains in the back, so you can also go hiking or boating in a lake if you would like. There's a lot of cabins up here which are nice to have access to in the wintertime by a snow machine. Right now, mainly it's the Pebble Mine, where they're trying to situate the Pebble Mine. The runoff waters would run into our region, and that's upsetting a lot of people who have not only grown up and lived here, but to a lot of other people who come in and try to fish in our waters as well.
Wanda Fulton and Stephanie McCumber live in Dillingham, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Alex Duer, Kristen Spack, Annie Fite, and Robert Woolsey. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Shaylin Cochran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our AK guest host this week was Shaylin Cochran. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.